We've got two very interesting presentations and not enough time, so we have to keep to schedule. Now, earlier this year, the GIPC established a working group to look into issues for actuaries around the insurance concentration, risk charge, and APRA's GPG 116. There are a few issues around interpretation. Can we put that way, Kate? Is that all right? And we thought it'd be very helpful to the profession to have a group of people qualified in the area to have a look at these issues, present at this seminar, get some feedback, prepare papers, and hopefully take it from there to perhaps ultimately some sort of information note for the profession, which will give a bit of guidance on how to interpret some of these issues. Now, it was too big a topic, so we had to split it into two. The first working group is dealing with natural perils. The second working group got to deal with everything else. And everything else with the name of other accumulations starts off vague and just gets better. But fortunately, we've got just the man for that in Warwick Guard, man of mystery. So I'm going to start with the natural perils paper, and that's going to be presented by Dr. Will Gardner. Now, I'll give you a quick background on Dr. Will. He's the... That's all right, isn't it? He's the founder and managing director of Combus Proprietary Limited. I think that's a recently created firm advising on reinsurance risk management. He's been working in the reinsurance industry and building and using catastrophe models since 1994, which is probably longer than any of us, almost certainly. He's a member of just about every actuarial institute you care to name, and too many for me to name, so we'll just leave it at that. But he's also a Bachelor of Economics in Actuarial Studies, and more importantly, he's a Doctor of Philosophy from the School of Physical Geography at Macquarie University. So without any more fuss, I'd like to welcome Will to the lectern.
Thanks, Scott. As Scott mentioned, this is just an overview of the working party project as opposed to any kind of insightful information on cap modelling. So if you came along to hear something, you know, deep and meaningful, I apologise, but it's more of a Cat 100, Cat 101. And that's what we aim to do in this working party. You know, we sat down at the start and said, you know, we can make this thing a really complicated, detailed paper and get right into the guts of it. Or we could do what we probably should have done, and that's what we did, was write a document that can be used to cover what APRA were looking for in terms of something that the board can read or board members can read on their flight to London or whatever they're doing. Can also be read by actuaries, can be read by cap modellers themselves. Probably more aimed at new modellers to the profession or people who have been doing it for a little while and want a refresher. And then also, I think it's a really good document. It's about 50 pages long. And for any of the people who are organising the GI course next year or for future years, I think it'd be a really good inclusion in the readings. It covers everything from start to finish on cap modelling. You know, again, it doesn't delve too deep, but it's actually quite a good coverage across it. So today I'm not going to go into too much detail, just give you some overview of the kind of things we've got in there. I must admit I'm not the main author of the paper. The main people who wrote it are unfortunately not here today. But again, really good document, and I think I recommend getting a copy and reading it, or at least passing it around to your board members so they can read it. So, you know, in terms of the modelling process, many of you would have seen this before. We've just, you know, represented it in some different manner, but the same thing. You've got your hazard model, your exposure model, your vulnerability model, your financial model, and your loss model. We go through each of the processes there. Just gave an introductory overview of that. Highlighting all the way through that cap models don't replace common sense. Anyone who saw my presentation yesterday on the disaster scenarios, you know, I'm a big believer of multi-model, not just meaning running a lot of these, but looking at different types of models as well. This paper's focusing on the stochastic cap models, but you need to consider those other ones as well, and we recognise that in the paper. And our main acknowledgement of uncertainty all the way through. We keep I think the word uncertainty probably appears 200 times in there. So just going through the stages, the exposure, you know, it's a bit hard to see here, but you've just got the country exposure, Cresta or ICA zone, going down the city, postal, down the geographic coordinates. In my experience of doing these modelling for many years, I think about 70% of the time of the whole process that an analyst does is loading the data in. The geographic part of it's always a hassle. You actually get probably more stuck on the individual large policies, like the commercial risks. That always seems to be a hassle. Most companies these days are getting pretty good at it, but that individual large policy, large commercial risks are still a problem. There's always fact data that's missing or inconsistent going through from the raw data through to, you know, where we're at, and we usually end up with coverage gaps or doubling up of coverage or modelling. We've gone through each of these in the paper. There's a fair bit of detail on each of these, so I won't go through them right now. But the big one, I guess, that stands out is the exposure. So actual data are assumed, and then coming back to looking at your data that you've modelled and going back to the person who's provided it to you, the business manager, or if you're a broker, going back to the company and saying, oh, here's what we modelled, does this look right? And that step gets missed a lot of times, and or it gets left too late, and you find out at the last minute that you're only modelling half the book or you're modelling, doing it all wrong. So I think going through that is a critical part of the process. Also looking at exposure movements, going from you know, last year to this year, what's happened, what's changed, have deductibles all shifted, has the exposure all grown on the southeast Queensland, or has something else happened? So I think there's two things there. There's the actual data issues where the data's changed, and there's also areas where your modelling has changed. You know, you usually get a fair bit of turnover. If there's any recruiters in the room, I know that's good for you, but the it's probably not that good for the companies who want their modelling done. You know, your model, you know, certain class of construction is one thing one year and there's another the next year, so documentation is critical. And we go a fair bit of that, fair bit into that in the paper. And we talk about the modelling, the vendor models that are out there, RMS, AIR and EQE. You should know that of these, the most recent model at this stage is the RMS model that was built in 2005, and the other models were built before that, so they're all pretty old. The good news is AIR and EQE are bringing out models this year. They've each had a seminar in Sydney, and you know, the people who use these models are working through them, testing them and trying to get a feel. In some ways it's good, but in other ways it's bad, in that the models start to converge after a while. You see, every time they do an update, they all seem to get closer together. I don't know how they know what the other models are, but they seem to always predict it and get them closer and closer each time. There's a concern here that I've got that we've had in Australia. I did a few years in the States, and when we're modelling there, we'd run the model, well, these three and a in-house model, and we'd always come back to the client and say, here's the four outputs. Now, in my experience in Australia, though, is the boards are a lot more pushy, and even the brokers are more pushy to the actuaries in the broking firms, and they're saying, okay, what's the answer? And we're forced here to select a number out of the models. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad. I guess it's like if you're doing reserving and you've got to choose a method, you need to put your judgment on it. But you know, if there's a way we can keep pushing back and saying, look, you know, there are three or four answers, and you know, your real we don't know where your answer is. It could be high as this or it could be as low as this. I think that's the better message. Going through the modelling process here, this is just a little bit more detail on the actual calculations. I don't know if I can get a laser pointer happening here. I think I won't risk it because I might muck the slides up. But the thank you. Where'd that come from? Right. Yeah. You've really just got the ground up at the top there. You've got your basic policy terms. You get your gross loss out. There's a lot of time spent trying to handle these enduring reinsurances. The fact, the quota share, the surplus. You know, I think in every one I've done, there's always some problem with them, and that ends up with the losses pre-cat, but you know, you've got to be very careful there that it's all matching through. Then we, you know, obviously we're running the cat models and getting the numbers out. We're typically doing the cat layering and analysis outside of the models, but the models can handle it internally if you want to run the cat layers through. But depending on how they work, there's different ways that the numbers can come out, so care needs to be taken there. We've got a couple of points at the bottom we talk about in fair detail in the paper. You know, in terms of the governance, we're talking about education and information transfer between the analytical team and the board. And in terms of ownership, APRA are pretty clear that the board needs to own this, although I guess the expectation is the actuary needs to own it as well. And they need to take the responsibility of getting the stuff done right, but the board needs to, I guess, you know, sign it off. So that's happening. And then I guess in the documentation, not only the strengths and weaknesses of the models themselves, but also the whole process, how well we've done it as we've gone out, how much peer review has gone into it. I'm not aware of any formal standards of peer review on cat modelling, but you know, good companies will do that anyway. So maybe down the track we'll end up with something, an actuarial guidance note on cat modelling peer review. Could be something that someone can write for the next one. In terms of the output, cat modelling has a great number of acronyms. You probably, anyone who was in the seismic presentation next door would have seen a lot of new ones there. A lot of great words. We've got the occurrence, exceedance, probability, event loss tables, aggregate exceedance probabilities, PML, blah, blah, blah. You know, the key thing here is understanding your data, understanding what's being modelled and what's missing, and understanding the variability in the output. There's a lot of simulation uncertainties. And you'll hear different things like, I mean, one of the modelling firms talks about secondary uncertainty, and people, or a lot of people, kind of conclude that that uncertainty encompasses all the underlying volatility. Well, it doesn't. It's probably, you know, one of, you know, 7 or 10 forms of uncertainty that's in the modelling. So you need to consider there is a huge amount. I mentioned yesterday that I had done some work where I've come up with a plus or a variation of about 100% on the 1 in 100 year number. Just to clarify, what I was talking about there is, you know, the standard deviation of the number, I believe, is about 100% upwards and maybe about 50% downwards. So it was kind of like double it or half it. That's what I meant by 100%. So sorry if it was unclear. But there is a huge range about the results. So considering different models and considering one model, there's huge uncertainty. Not unlike reserving, I think. Or some people might disagree. Jeremy and Adam did some work on the... you know, what we thought were the critical points for the introduction of the horizontal requirement. We've made the assumption that people are buying cover to the top of their vertical, so there's no charge there, and it's all really coming out of the bottom. So what we've done here, we've said, just made a little example. I don't know if you can all see this, but going down the columns, or down the each row, are different retention levels, and we've got what the horizontal requirement would have been under the former regime and what it is now. The conclusion here is, you know, depending on what your retention is and what your PMLs are, you could be looking at about a 3 or 4 times increase in your charge there as a result of this change. There's a few things that come in that you need to consider here. It's how you're modelling your low return periods. The vendor models don't do the low return periods very well, so cyclone and earthquake models are great at the 1 in 100 level, still considering the volatility, but down under about a 10-year, they don't cover it well, so you need to model bushfire, flood, storm and hail separately. So there's a lot of uncertainty there. You also need to allow for El Niño, La Niña, and how you put it through your simulation tools, whether you're running it as a Poisson or a negative binomial. How long have I got? 1 minute? Or am I over?
Four including questions.
Okay, I've only got 2 slides. The premium liability offset needs to be calculated, and it's assumed that we get this out of the cat modelling output. We've got a fair bit of detail in here in the paper, you know, going through this formula. I won't go through it now, but the issue is that we need to allow for the different margins, and we need to allow for the fact that we've got the combination of the vendor models and other modelling that we need to put on there. So anything that we create in terms of another perils model, like say a bushfire model, we need to convert that into an average loss in those layers. So we can't just draw a line. We've got to make some kind of distribution out of that so we can calculate the area under the curve. So that makes it tricky. So I'm assuming there will be huge variation in this, in the calculations of these over the next year or two, and APRA can have a lot of fun trying to interpret them. So just concluding here, again, it's a paper that's designed to be a CAT 101 or CAT 100. It's aimed to be read by people. The aim was not to give you everything today. Please download it there and have a look. We think, you know, some of the conclusions out of it is that the ICRC is going to be a critical part of the calculation, and the low return periods are going to drive it a fair bit. And again, just the whole, you know, cap models are not replacing common sense. Don't turn off the common sense switch when you're looking at these. You know, look at the thing and say, does it look right? Run some other models. You know, look at your exposure. Look at you know, disaster scenarios or any other methods as well as these. But these do provide you with some good data and some good information to use in your pricing and everything else. And the last thing there is a quote: all models are wrong, some models are useful, which sums it all up. Okay, I guess I'll pass it over now to continue on with the other accumulations. Unless there's any questions on this section.
Yeah, we'll take questions now. If you've got any questions, you can just use the microphone up there. It's probably going to be a microphone. Okay.
No questions again?
No questions.
All right, cool.
I've got a question for you. How do you think the competitive tension between the cap modelling firms operates? Is it healthy in terms of the results they're coming out with? And do you think there's any sort of an analogy with credit rating firms?
I think it's been a three-horse race in these thing, and they come ahead and they fall behind all the time. But the big driver has been the US and the other key risk zones around the world. You know, their focus on Australia and some of the smaller risk accumulation areas has been, you know, very slow and very limited. But frankly, they don't really care that much about us. You know, we're getting, you know, a couple of $1 million to them each year, whereas, you know, they're getting tens of millions or hundreds of millions of income out of the US. So, you know, there is competition out here, and I think, you know, disasters in this region actually help the competition. You know, it means, well, they're focusing more on our region. They know that those accumulations are going to affect reinsurers' decisions, and so those same reinsurers are talking to them and saying, yeah, we want a better model for Australia, a better model for New Zealand, and they will improve. But, I think all of their stuff's good. It's all useful. And, you know, I recommend keep using those models. But, you know, take everything else into account.
Right. Question, Sue.
Yeah, go.
A lot of people spoke about flood yesterday. How do you think that companies, not just the large ones that can develop their own models in-house, the small ones, how are they coping with modelling flood going forward? Given it's going to be a coverage that's more widespread these days.
Frankly, I'm not too sure of what they're doing. I guess I need to get out there and find out. National flood database is useful, but it's only, you know, one part of data that you need to build the model. I know that Risk Frontiers have been actively marketing their tools, and some of the smaller companies that I know of have been using broker tools to just do a rough model. But it's I think they're kind of being left behind a little bit, and it must be difficult. So I don't know if any of the small insurers are here. There's a few around. Maybe they could comment in the break or now. Yep, thanks.